Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm glad so many of you decided to venture out on a night like this, and I feel quite confident that you'll be glad you did. We are particularly delighted to have this opportunity to have Nat Hentoff address Lehigh University and the Lehigh Valley community. Mr. Hentoff is serving as the first Joseph B. McFadden Distinguished Professor, a professorship made possible through the generosity of Robert Rodale, a member of the class of 1952, and now chairman of the board of Rodale Press in Emmaus. And of course, the professorship was named for the man who headed the Division of Journalism at Lehigh for more than 30 years. Both Mr. Rodale and Professor McFadden are here tonight, and I would appreciate it if they would stand so that we can acknowledge the contribution both have made to Lehigh University. Thirty-four. Seems like 40. Our speaker tonight has had a long and distinguished career in various phases of journalism. After graduating from Northeastern University in Boston with highest honors in 1946, he did graduate work at Harvard and at the Sorbonne as a Fulbright Fellow. He became associate editor of Downbeat magazine in 1954 and served as a reviewer for a number of publications. In 1958, he became a columnist for the Village Voice, a position he still holds. He also has served as a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine and has contributed articles to many other publications. In addition, he currently writes a column entitled Sweet Land of Liberty for the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times News Service. Professor Hentoff has written a number of books, including seven novels, on a wide variety of topics. Much of his earlier writing was devoted to jazz, a subject in which he still has a strong interest. However, as he once observed, from jazz, I inevitably became involved in the world that jazz itself reflects, and I therefore began to write about civil rights. That naturally led to the problems of poverty and ways to end it. Other topics on which Professor Hentoff has written extensively include racism, police espionage, educational reform, and First Amendment rights. It was, of course, his work on the First Amendment that led to his appointment as McFadden Professor. But we are delighted that Mr. Hentoff has expertise not only in that field, but in so many others. However, it is difficult to categorize Professor Hentoff. He has described himself as an advocacy writer. In introducing him to his first class a few weeks ago, I described him as a distinguished writer, which I believe is an accurate assessment. However, he quickly disavowed that description and said it would be more accurate to call him a troublemaker. Whatever the case, you will be able to judge for yourselves as he discusses a responsible press and quickly raises the question, responsible to whom? It is my pleasure to present Professor Nat Hentoff.
I soon found out that being the first Joe McFadden Professor presents a certain kind of challenge. It's like you go into a band for the first time and you carry a horn and the band leader says, well, that's where you sit and these are your parts. Oh, I ought to tell you, the cat who just preceded you was Dizzy Gillespie. I may eventually get to the main theme tonight, which is responsible press, responsible to whom. But I want to, by way of prologue, talk about really a corollary or an underlying element of that theme. And that is, and this is a commonplace, that in the last 5, 6, 7 years, the press has become increasingly distrusted and disliked by a larger percentage, larger and larger percentage of the citizenry. There was a brief period when just the opposite was happening, right after Watergate, when everybody thought that the Republic had been saved because of Bob Redford and Dustin Hoffman and Jason Robards. But that didn't last. And the reasons it didn't last, well, the cliche reasons, but that doesn't make them any the less accurate, are, among other things, that the press is arrogant. If there were an arrogance cup, Time magazine has retired it, despite the fact that the jury in the Sharon Time Inc. case said that Sharon had indeed been defamed, his reputation had indeed been harmed, and that that defamation was a false piece of reporting, but that nonetheless the jury could not give him any money because he had not fallen, that is, what had written about him had not fallen into the definition of actual malice, which, because he is a public figure, means that he and his lawyers had to prove that not only had he been defamed, not only had it been a false piece of information, but Time Inc. had gone ahead and printed what they had with reckless disregard as to whether it was true or not, or with knowing that it was false. The jury could not find that. The jury did, however, and this is rather singular in these cases, append a statement to its verdict, which essentially said that Time magazine had won, a statement saying that the magazine, or at least its correspondents, Halevi and its editors in New York, had been negligent and careless, which is a nice piece of understatement. Thereafter, Time magazine, in an official statement, said that it had no reason whatever to change its reporting or editorial practices. That's why it wins the Arrogance Cup. The feeling also is that the press is reckless, that it is gratuitously and callously intrusive into privacy. But I think there is another reason why the press is so disliked, and it may be a more profound reason than any of the others. And that is that the press has become, by and large, so big that there is no way a reader or viewer aware, watching something, reading something, aware that according to his information and his experience, this particular piece of journalism is a disgrace, distorted, it's outrageous. There's no way he can get back at the press because access is so limited as to be almost impossible for most people. This does not, obviously, operate in those small towns or reasonably small towns where even if you can't get your letter into the paper, you're going to see the editor on the street. Then you can get some pretty swift access. In fact, in the 19th century, it usually was accompanied by a horsewhip. So the reader was no longer frustrated. My older son, works as a journalist in White Plains, Arizona, a very small place. And everybody in town tells him what they think of what he's put in the paper, including the dogs. So there is no frustration there. But most other places, there is the sense that the press gets away with all this stuff and there's nothing you can do about it. There's almost a symbolic manifestation of that. I don't know about around here, but in New York City, to simply get into the building, I'm not talking about getting into the pages, to get into the building of the New York Times is a very fearsome experience, because they have down in the lobby, which looks like an outpost of the Pentagon, a bunch of guards, uniformed guards with walkie-talkies and very unfriendly faces. Even the kindly village voice, the so-called contra-cultural publication, you want to get into the voice now, you're going to go up to the second floor where we all are in the newsroom, and there is a locked gate which is opened only by an electronic signal. And you cannot get in through that gate unless you tell who you're going to see. And even then you can't get through because who you're going to see has to come out and escort you back. There is some kind of symbiotic relationship there. I haven't quite fully plumbed it. But it certainly does not give the people who come to the newspaper any sense that they're welcome. Now, I'll give you my own autobiographical story of access to the media. During the presidential campaign, the primaries, the Democratic primaries, Louis Farrakhan was a figure of some prominence. He was at the time a close associate of Jesse Jackson. He often introduced Jesse at rallies. And he was defending Jesse after a reporter for the Washington Post, a black reporter, Milton Coleman, wrote a piece, or rather gave information to a reporter for the Post who wrote a piece, that said that Jesse had talked about New York as Jaime Town and about Jews as Jaimes. That report is generally felt by the Jackson camp to have hurt him very badly when he was beginning to show some momentum. Farrakhan was on Ted Koppel's Nightline. And he was explaining to Koppel why he felt that Milton Coleman had betrayed his people, that Milton Coleman owed it to black people in America to be loyal first to Jesse Jackson and only second to the news, or to the reporting of the news as it is conventionally regarded. And that is why Farrakhan explained he had placed a curse on Milton Coleman and on his wife and otherwise acted rather beastly toward the reporter. Then he decided to show Ted Koppel, Cabot couldn't begin to compete with that guy, he decided to show Koppel that it wasn't just a black thing he was talking about. Not only blacks knew that they had to be loyal to their people first, he said, I'll tell you, for example, there is a very well-respected reporter in New York named Nat Hentoff, thank you very much, Minister, who said recently on a program called Like It Is in New York that whenever he goes to do a story, he judges how he's going to play that story, how he's going to write about the person who is the center of the story, by how that person feels toward Israel. If the person is hostile to Israel, Hentoff will do a number on him. That, in any way you ought to define it, is defamation of a reporter. Because what he said was that I'm just a PR guy. Worse than that, that you can't trust anything I report because I have this prior, deeper loyalty to the state of Israel. I did not hear this at the time. I was on a train coming back out of Pennsylvania. My wife, who was not a night person, however, was up at 3 in the morning when I came home. She was so angry. She had called ABC Nightline in Washington and called it in New York, and she got what she usually get. Thank you very much, ma'am. We'll sure bring it to their attention the next day. The next day at 8 in the morning, to show I was serious, I woke up a friend of mine on the show, she's a producer, who calls me every once in a while for ideas as to guests and whatever. And I said, I demand access. She knows, unfortunately, that I don't believe in libel law. I think all libel law violates the First Amendment, so I couldn't say I'm going to sue you bastards. If I had sued them, I would have made a fair amount of money. Also might have been killed before I could enjoy it, but never mind. My family would have had it. So I said to her, look, I got to get on the air. I mean, this is terrible. They had meetings all day long, I was told. They had never, ever put anybody on the air to rebut criticism. They were not going to start this disgraceful practice now. And I kept after them. And finally, I got a call about 6:30, and she said, "Ted has looked at the tapes from last night, and he thinks you have a point. Why don't you come up?" And Jeff Greenfield interviewed me for about 20 minutes, and they picked out a nice 22-second part of that. But at least I was on the air, and I said what I wanted to say. However, if I had not known that producer, if I had been a columnist in Cleveland, or for that matter, a columnist in New York, and called up and insisted I get on, I would not have gotten on. Not that it helps entirely. I still get letters every once in a while and phone calls from people who, in connection with something else I've written, they don't like. And of course, what do I expect from you? You're a lousy propagandist. You said that, what do you mean I said? You said that Israel came first, and how a person reacted to Israel was how you would play a story. By the way, the Farrakhan statement was not entirely inaccurate. The accurate part was I had been on Like It Is. It's a black television show out of New York run by Gil Noble, and there was a program that concerned Milton Coleman, what he had done, and that subject. Should a reporter, who should a reporter be responsible for, to, if he's black or Jewish or whoever, his people or reporting? And I was the only white guy on that show, and the show split in half. Les Payne of Newsday, who was a Pulitzer Prize winner and the national news editor there, and a columnist, and I were arguing that you cannot have journalism that anybody will trust if you start tailoring it according to whatever your ethnic or other allegiances are, if you have any such allegiances. But I was on the show. It's just that Farrakhan said that I had said something exactly the opposite of what I had said. Now, I'll give you another example, much more unfortunate and, I think, destructive example of access. How many of you saw the 60-minute program on South Africa? Not many, I'm glad to see. December 16th of last year, Morley Safer went to South Africa. The intent of the program, he said in the opening of the script, and I was told by a friend of mine who was the second in command there, he runs the day-to-day operations, Phil Shefflin, we wanted to show the other side. Nobody knows the other side. The other side presumably meant the minority white government ruling over 22 million blacks. Okay, that's a sound journalistic principle. I can see sending somebody to talk to Pinochet or to talk to the ruler north or South Korea or Czechoslovakia or whatever. But is it indeed responsible journalism to just run what they say with either no interpretative comment of your own or, as Morley Safer did, with the clear sense that he was agreeing and affirming with what Prime Minister Botha of South Africa was saying, that yes, there were some problems, they don't have any political rights, but things are getting better. And it struck me that that kind of program was very much like, oh, let's say a news crew went over to Germany in the 1930s. Good journalism. Let's see what their Führer has to say. By the way, one expects that in that kind of an interview, you will give him a few mildly tough questions. Safer addressed Botha as if he were the cardinal of some church that Safer was a penitent in. Utter respect and deference. All right, so you go to the 30s, and you listen to their Führer, and you record what he says, and that's it. You don't say anything about whether what he's saying happens to be accurate or not. You don't manage to drop in at the nearest local concentration camp. You just go back home. It was the most unprofessional alleged news program I've ever seen. By the way, there was nothing anywhere in it to indicate that in the 4 months before airtime, 160 blacks had been killed in resistance to this government that was making progress. One was killed, not only one, but one in particular was killed who was not resisting at all. It was a six-year-old child in a black township, shot in the back. Two black girls, 15 and 16, repeatedly raped by white South African police in an armored police van. Nowhere was there the slightest indication, as the New Yorker had said just a week before, the most remarkable, in fact, the miracle of South Africa is that a nonviolent movement still exists. Well, Randall Robinson, who is executive director of TransAfrica, which has been arranging and sustaining all these various demonstrations in front of South African embassies around the country, Randall Robinson wrote to CBS and asked for a chance to answer back. And he was told that it was certainly beyond any question that he could not answer back because it was against company policy. They gave ample response. And if you watch 60 Minutes, you know what that ample response is. It's at the end of the program the following week, there are snippets from a few letters, pro and con, read by, in this case, Morley Safer, a dispassionate observer, as part of an entertainment section. They treat letters as, you know, it's just fun for the end of the show. What would have been wrong in terms of sound journalistic practice if they had given Randall Robinson, or for that matter, Bishop Tutu, who could have been taped in South Africa, 15 minutes, 10 minutes, even 5 minutes to respond to this totally misleading program. Now, by the way, in terms of access too, and I don't have many solutions for this, I do think that television stations fall down abominably on even beginnings of access, and some stations you get this pro forma thing, you can come and answer something. But it is so arranged, so staged, and I even would say so lighted, that it's an immediate invitation to go to the refrigerator. It is not set in any kind of inviting context the way everything else is done on television. Newspapers have letters to the editor, but not nearly enough. Meg Greenfield, who runs the editorial page of the Washington Post, did something I think very useful about 3 years ago. Now, in the Saturday Post, in addition to the regular, well, it's like a regular half page, three-quarter page of letters on the editorial page, there is now a full page, extra page of letters. It's good, but it's still not enough. They get about 50,000 letters a year, the Washington Post. They print less than 10%. And if I ran a paper, there'd be a lot more space for readers, not only letters, but a lot more op-ed page pieces, not only by the well-known experts like Henry Kissinger, who really could take a moratorium from experting for a few years, but people who nobody knows who have something to say. But none of that's going to happen. Now, as to the responsibility of the press and responsible to whom, I'm going to tell you two stories. This is from a clipping in the New York Times, October 30th, 1983. Everything about the ship was big, from her 618-foot length to her mammoth derricks, and $200 million price tag. The name of the ship was the Glomar Explorer. Anybody here ever hear of the Glomar Explorer? I figure this is a hip place. It was built in 1973 by Howard Hughes on commission from the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, what that means is that you and I paid for that. and a few other people because it cost $500 million. She had just, the ship only had one mission in life, and the mission was called Project Jennifer. Project Jennifer was a secret attempt to raise a submarine, a Soviet submarine, that had sunk in the Pacific in 1968. It had a rather nice cargo aboard. It had nuclear warheads and code books. The salvage attempt was made in 1974 at a depth of 3 miles. The Glomar Explorer, I've seen the diagrams and that sort of thing. Glomar Explorer was a marvelous piece of work. It was out of Jules Verne or out of Star Trek. If you put Star Trek underwater, why not? It was this huge apparatus that scuttled around the ocean floor and could pick up all kinds of things. Sometimes it didn't pick it all up, though. That was the problem. When they tried that operation in 1974, they brought up only half of the Soviet submarine, the half that had some dead Russians in it, but no code books and no nuclear warheads. The CIA, I really don't like Morley Safer, I can see that. The CIA desperately wanted to go back again and bring up the real stuff. And their thereupon began. To my knowledge, which admittedly is not all that extensive, but at least within modern times, as they say, the most successful and extensive manipulation of the press by the United States government, resulting in collective self-censorship. William Colby was the director of the CIA then. I'm sure you've seen him since on television. He looks like Wally Cox grown up, very unthreatening fellow, very mild, very reasonable. And he started to go around to the offices of the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times and NBC and ABC News and CBS News and public radio, National Public Radio, and public television. And he said, it's terribly important that this story be squelched. He knew that Cy Hirsch had been working on the story for the New York Times. Jack Nelson had been working on it for the Washington Post. By the way, somebody had it for the Chicago Tribune, which had to have also been visited. Colby said, you just can't do this. It's in the highest interest of national security that we bring back the rest of the sub without the Russians knowing about it. And everyone agreed. Catherine Graham and Ben Bradley at the Washington Post and Mabe Rosenthal at the New York Times. I suppose Punch Sulzberger was in the room, but he was probably reading something else. It was a marvelous piece of subversion of the First Amendment. On a Monday morning, I got a call from a lawyer in Washington who I knew slightly. No, I knew him better than slightly, but not all that well. He was a lawyer with a lot of connections, and he was furious. He knew what was going on. I don't know how he knew, but he knew. He said, I got a story for you. I figure the Village Voice will print anything, which was, I thought, gratuitously insulting, but I listened anyway. He said, and he began to outline some of what the story was and explained that he was angry because none of the so-called reputable media would print it. So he said, would you do it? I said, I can't say yes without looking at the thing, without checking it out, and I got to get permission from the editor. I'm not the editor. So he said, you'll get it. You'll get the stuff. And 4 or 5 hours later, delivered at my door, was a package that it's the kind of story you dream about getting. I mean, because you had phone numbers all down one side and cross-connecting phone numbers and background stuff and pictures and just superb, with the whole story of the financing of it and everything else. And I called the editor. This was a Monday. We don't go to press until, we go to bed on Tuesday. There's no way I could have checked it out at all well just in a day. You can do that, but I wouldn't want to do that in this kind of story. And I figured I'm safe. All these other people are sitting on a story. So he said, if it checks out, we'll run it. We'll give the whole thing. Front page, whole business, just like the movies. And in 3 or 4 days, it was clear to me that the story was very accurate indeed, and we got it set up. We got the art going and everything else for the next issue. We would have printed the following Tuesday. On Monday night of that week, Jack Anderson broke the story on the radio. And there was my last chance, my only chance to win the Pulitzer Prize. But the interesting thing and the predictable thing was the next morning, there was Cy Hirsch's story in the New York Times, and there was Jack Nelson's story in the LA Times, and all over the place the story was of nothing had happened and nobody said one word in print at any of those places about how they had censored themselves. It turned out that Colby had lied. The main reason for keeping the story out of print was so the Russians wouldn't know. Turned out the Russians are not that stupid. You lose a submarine with all that stuff in it, you're going to go around that area trying to figure out what happened. And that there was a Russian trawler standing by watching the Glomar doing its thing. And they waited to see if it was going to come back. And Jack Anderson broke that story too. This is the way it went. So the Russians knew. We knew they knew. They knew we knew they knew. But as Colby told us, it would be rubbing their noses in it to let the American people know. So, what was at stake in publishing or not publishing that story was not national security, not at all, but international etiquette. Not American secrets, but Soviet face. Not the sabotage of a second Glomar mission, but the ruffling of Russian tail feathers, if we should go ahead with it. Unquote, Jack Anderson. So in order to save Soviet face, the New York Times, though they didn't know this, but they could have found out, if he could find out, I mean, Jack Anderson is not the most respected journalist in the United States by other journalists. If he with his staff could find out what was going on, how come they couldn't? Because they didn't try to. Once the decision had been made by the top executives to kill the story, or at least delay it, that was it. Tom Wicker, in a postlude, said, as is almost always the case with national security stories, in retrospect, it is hard to see how a news organization, let alone so many, could have thought such a story ought to be withheld. Ben Bradley said, after the egg had been taken off his face, well, this happens more often than the public might think. What happens more often than the public might think? That people like Colby come around, or that people like Bradley and Rosenthal, et cetera, listen to them and do what they want? Then the other question came up. At least I thought it was another question. What about the stake reporters have in the responsibility of the press when their bosses do something that violates the integrity of the press, let alone the First Amendment? Abe Rosenthal of the Times who is now the executive editor. He was always the executive editor, even when he was 8 years old, but I forget what his real title then. Anyway, he told Newsweek that after he and Punch Salzberg had made their deal with William Colby, Rosenthal did not inform Cy Hirsch of what had happened. He just told him to sit on the story. "I wouldn't bother a reporter with that," said Rosenthal, "with what had happened or why." It was Hirsch's story, and he had done a lot of work on it. But what are the journalists like Jack Nelson, first-class reporter? He's now the Washington bureau chief of the Washington Times. He'd die if he heard that, of the L.A. Times. You've probably seen him on public television. He was on recently in one of those excellent Fred Friendly programs, The Constitution, The Delicate Balance. This one was about national security, and there was Jack Nelson saying, "If I got a classified document, the hell with everybody in the government, I'm going to run with it." But back then, Nelson had the story, did not run with it. Why? He said, many reporters thought the story should be run, including, he might have added, himself. But I respect William Thomas's decision. Thomas was the editor-in-chief of the L.A. Times. It was his decision to make. Struck me as kind of the Eichmann principle as applied to reporters. Are superiors' orders never to be questioned in public? How much of a struggle did reporters put up, I don't know, in the publications on whom Colby cast his spell? Is there a point, can there be a point, at which a reporter, unable to get a very important story printed in his own paper or her own paper, because of government interference, because of the stupidity of his superiors in believing the government, is there a point in which the reporter ought to give it to another paper? Leak it. We live by leaks. Everybody in the business lives by leaks. But reporters will not leak a story in their own shop, properly so, if the story is being worked on. But if the story is being suppressed, and it's an important story, what is the ethical reason why you should not leak it? That particular point of view got me into a fair amount of trouble with some of those reporters, especially Jack Nelson. I think he's still angry at me. In fact, the only reporter for years who ever came up to me and said that, you know, that's a good point, was predictably Dustin Hoffman, or better known as Cal Bernstein. Now, let me tell you a little bit more about this in terms of the responsibility of the press. I have felt for years that this story should be told like a journalist St. Swithin's Day. Once a year, maybe on the anniversary of John Peter Zenger getting put in the hoosegow, journalists should talk about this in newsrooms. I mention it every place I can where I'm talking about journalism or even where I'm not. I mentioned it when I was asked by the students to give a graduation talk at Columbia School of Journalism in the presence of a professor who was part of management of Newsweek at the time and helped suppress the story. It's interesting to watch the colors on his face. This is a story that Jack Nelson told afterward. How this stuff works. Colby told the L.A. Times people, and he did this with everybody else on his list, all the responsible publications. He'd come in and he'd say to Catherine Graham or to Bill Thomas or whoever, I got all the other responsible publications locked up. The Times is with us, NPR is with us, etc. So that technically, although each paper, magazine, and network decided for itself to stay mute, actually, each knew that a number of other distinguished, responsible news organizations had already fallen into line. Then Colby said, it's a story he told them all, Colby said, if the story spreads to the crazies, you know what he means by the crazies, Rolling Stone, Village Voice, whatever, Ramparts if it was around then, he said, if the story spreads to the crazies, that wouldn't make any difference because they would lack credibility. If all the responsible organizations, news organizations, are silent, they'll say that's the Village Voice again, those loonies, which is what our owner, Rupert Murdoch, calls us. The other thing that came out of this was really no thing at all. That is, there was no sense in the aftermath on the part of any of the reporters involved that I know about, and I know most of them, that they should have leaked the story. After I wrote a column on this for the Village Voice, a young journalist wrote in to say that I was being very harsh and utterly unreasonable to expect even well-known reporters to get a story out against the wishes of management. And the journalist ended his letter by saying, you know, you got to realize reporters got to eat too. And my answer to him and to that point of view was, eat what? Now, the other thing in terms of responsibility of the press, it's my second favorite story on this theme, of to whom should the press be responsible, has to do with a case that I think most of you probably know or know something about. And that's the case of the Progressive magazine. You all know that case, the Progressive magazine, how to make an H-bomb and what the government did. I'll give you a little background on it because it's part of this whole context. They had a piece by a young guy named Howard Moreland. And it really was, on the surface, it was how to assemble an H-bomb. What it actually was intending to do was to show that this secrecy that the government continually covered up all matters to do with atomic warfare and for that matter, arms talk, saying we can't give you any of this information, it's too secret. He wanted to show how nonsensical this is. So what he did was, he went around the country interviewing scientists, atomic scientists, obviously. He went to libraries, including government libraries, without touching one inch of classified material. He wrote this piece. The mistake the Progressive made was, not before it was published, it didn't send it to the government. They're not that dumb. But they sent it around to several atomic scientists to see if it really checked out, if it was accurate. Their mistake was not in doing that, but in not being more careful to whom they sent it. Because one of the people they sent it to is a professor at MIT who works for the government, who immediately called James Schlesinger, who was then Secretary of Defense, and practically on the next plane to Madison, Wisconsin, which is where the Progressive is published, there was a whole load of FBI agents and lawyers from the Justice Department who stormed into the editor's office, Irwin Noel, and said, forget it, you're not going to print this. It's a violation of the Atomic Energy Act, it's this, it's that. Irwin Noel is a very old-fashioned journalist. Whatever he has, he prints, at least by his judgment. And most important, he believes in Izzy Stone's dictum, which I learned from Izzy when I was very young, and which I transmit to all the reporters I know, never, ever trust the government. Never. Doesn't matter who's in power. They're always lying. So Noel said he wasn't going to do that. He was going to publish. Well, they went to court. They had an unfortunate federal district judge in Madison who put on a prior restraint, which means that you can't publish. It turned out to be the longest prior restraint in American history. I think it lasted about 7 months. And there was a huge battle inside the press. I think most of the public figured that Irwin Noel should at best be guillotined and probably should be drawn and quartered on prime time. Within the press, however, there was a big debate. Now let me backtrack a second. The judge in Madison said to the Progressive, why don't you, all these things always sound so reasonable, why don't you negotiate a settlement with the government? Take out the more sensitive parts of the article. By the way, the propaganda was by a number of newspaper columnists, as well as from James Schlesinger, who was calling up newspaper columnists and editorial writers. They were saying, if this article is printed, Idi Amin will be able to buy a copy of the Progressive for, what is it, $1.25, and be able to make an H-bomb. Of course, he'd need a few billion dollars besides, but never mind. A lot of people believe that. Anyway, they said, so make an agreement. Just take out some of those sensitive parts of the piece, and then you'll run the rest. And Noel said, no. I don't believe the First Amendment is negotiable. If the founders had intended it to be negotiable, they would have written a mediation process into the Constitution. He is so marvelously stubborn that as the months went on, the ACLU joined his lawyers to fight this, and to get involved in the case, you needed security clearance to pour through the government's arguments, etc., about the need for extreme secrecy of this kind of stuff. The ACLU lawyers went through the process and got security clearance. Irwin Noel refused to. He says, I'm not going to have the government certify whether I'm a patriot or not, or able to argue my own case. So he stayed on the sidelines coaching from there. A good many, as I said, newspapers urged the Progressive to settle, to do anything. You're creating bad law. The Washington Post had an editorial that was headed John Mitchell's Dream Case. In other words, John Mitchell, the distinguished attorney general at the time. In fact, we've never had anyone as distinguished until Mr. Meese gets sworn in. Mitchell was looking for a chance to get the press. And if you could show him a case where the damn press is about to publish an article on how to make an H-bomb, what a boon that is to Mitchell. Irwin Moreland would not yield. This went on, as I say, for some time. Meanwhile, I was getting, and other reporters around the country who follow this stuff was getting, some very strange things in the mail. One time, the guy who handles mail at my building said, some kid brought this in, and it's a long, design or blueprint or something. And there was a note attached to it. Said, this is what Moreland was writing about, although I think this is better. I don't know anything about this stuff. I am technologically ignorant. But I brought it to somebody who does. And he says, yeah, if you have a number of billion dollars, you can build an H-bomb out of that. And other people were doing the similar things. There was a guy out in California, an autodidact, a science autodidact. I think his main job, I think he made his living in dog breeding or something. But he was absolutely immersed in this stuff. And he was sending these long, he'd never seen the Moreland article. Nobody had seen the Moreland article except the editors of the Progressive and the judge and the lawyers. But he was sending around articles on how to make an H-bomb just to prove that Moreland ought not to be penalized and the Progressive ought not to be penalized. And then I got a call, this is another story just like the other one, from somebody who said, I have the manuscript. Not Moreland's manuscript, but it's another manuscript that will tell you how to make an H-bomb. And if you want to help Moreland and the Progressive, you'll print it, because it'll make the FBI and the government and Schlesinger look like the idiots they are. There's nothing secret about this. So I said, fine, the voice will print anything. But I had it checked out. It was fine. And this time it was on the damn presses. When the same guy who had not told me this had sent it to the Chicago Tribune, and they were out with it that day. What happened to the case of the government against the Progressive was that as this stuff began to appear in more and more publications, the case simply fell apart. There was no secrecy violated in this piece, How to Build an H-Bomb. And the prior restraint was lifted, and Irwin Noel has never forgiven most of the press ever since, because most of the responsible newspapers were telling him to cave in. I was talking about this case to George Reedy, who is now head of the journalism school at Marquette. And Reedy was, for some time, Lyndon Johnson's press secretary, which must have been a laugh and a half. A very cool, sensible, very, very experienced journalist. He said, when I got to be the president's press secretary, I went to the Atomic Energy Department and I said, look, I don't know anything about what you folks are doing. And I don't want to make any mistakes, so I wish you'd tell me what's secret here. So the guy in charge of that division said to Reedy, come here. And he took him into a small office, locked the door, and said, this is not to get out. There is nothing secret here. They know what we know what they know. Now, let's see, last thing, I want to talk about how I got involved with my concern about to whom the press ought to be responsible. When I was going to school, to college in Boston at Northeastern, I started as a reporter and then a feature writer and a columnist, and then I was the editor of the Northeastern News. And by that time, we had a really good staff. I mean, we're all troublemakers. And we ran pieces about how the sports department was not only getting too much of the budget, they didn't even know what to do with what they had. And we were doing pieces on, at the time, Boston was the most anti-Semitic city in the country. We won a prize for that. So we were doing pieces on who was bankrolling some of the sects, the worst of them. And then we started to do, it was my idea, I am proud to say, we started to do profiles of the members of the Board of Trustees. Why were they on the board? What was their educational background, or what was their educational reason for being on the board, aside from giving money? And apparently a couple of phone calls were made to the president, Carl S. L., and all of us were ordered to the Dean of Administration's office, and we were told, you got two choices. You can either keep all of your reporting to the campus and make it positive, or you can leave. So we left. Naturally, there are always scabs around, and the paper never missed an issue. But it struck us, without sounding too pompous about it. I mean, we were, you know, in a sense, I mean, all I knew was George Seldes at the time. He was my hero, still is. Man's over 90 years old, and he's got a new book coming out. What we felt was, and there's no way to put it that I can think of that doesn't sound pompous, is that it would have been irresponsible to the student body if we acceded to that kind of iron curtain demands. We also felt bad. We were very lonely. We'd lost our home. We had an around-the-clock blackjack game in that place. But we had to do it. And I must say, as far as I know, or am conscious of, I have never looked back since. Nor have I ever doubted to whom the press ought to be responsible. Okay. Questions, arguments, denunciations, whatever. Anyone? Can't be all consonants. Yeah. Well, that was a disgraceful business about 3 weeks ago when, again, in almost in concert, like with the Glomar Explorer, the various television networks and a good many newspapers, but not the Washington Post, I am glad to say, were so intimidated by the government, by Cap Weinberger, obviously a trustworthy man, just look at him. Cap Weinberger was saying, anybody reports anything that's going to be on this military flight, that's going to ruin any chances of our disarmament talks, and it might get us into another war and all that stuff. And the worst statement I heard was by a guy named Grossman, Larry Grossman, who I am sorry to say lives in my building, is the president of NBC News, and said, we are a news network, but first of all, we are an American network. So I wouldn't watch NBC News anymore if I were you. Yeah. Yes.
You talked earlier about a perception of arrogance. Isn't that perception of arrogance going to be, isn't that made worse when we're seen as being, when we're seen as being anti-patriotic? How do we deal with that public perception that if we print news about the space shuttle, we're anti-Americans? We ran an editorial saying this policy was silly, and we got nasty letters from our readers saying, you know, why don't you write for Pravda?
Well, you're always going to get some of those because they don't really read the story. They just know, think they have an idea of what you're doing. But I think it could have been done in some places, the few places that I saw that handled it, in a way that made it more clear to the reader, like, let's say this last thing with the military stuff, that this has appeared in Aviation Week. This has appeared in this. We are not telling you anything that has not already appeared in the press. The Russians know, there are Russians who know how to read English. And it is important for the American people to know what's going on, because if, for example, let's say not this time, but if, for example, the kind of military load goes up that is going to geometrically expand surveillance power, the Russians are going to be very unhappy about that, and they may do something in retaliation. And if the American public doesn't know what was on that flight that caused the retaliation, they're going to get so angry at the retaliation that we all might get incinerated. There really ought to, there has to be openness in this stuff, it seems to me, up to a point. Ah, what's the point? That's a real problem. What is the point? Because my feeling, as I think I made clear, is you can't trust the government. You can't trust yourself unless you're an expert on science some of the time. So I think you have to have people to whom you have access as an editor, let's say, whom you can ask about these things. Then my crude hypothetical here is, in this kind of situation, is suppose a reporter gets from a disaffected source in the Pentagon, disaffected with the mishigas that's going on at the Pentagon, a plan, and the plan checks out that this is a plan, serious plan, not just a hypothetical, a serious plan for a preventive strike at China. What's the responsibility of the paper if the editor has now very good reason to believe that this is real? Not that they're going to do it tomorrow, but that it's there. They're thinking about it. What does he do? Huh? Anybody? I'd run it because I don't want to take the chance of a nuclear holocaust. And you have a much better chance of avoiding it by letting people know what the hell is going on and how crazy they are to do such a thing by my standards. I mean, I'm with the Catholic bishops on this whole nuclear war stuff. Now, another editor might have another point of view entirely, but I would run it. And I would have no hesitation whatever once I knew it was real. Yeah.
What amazes me about the shuttle thing is that no reporters have asked, well, how could the Russians possibly not know exactly what they're doing up there?
Yeah.
The technology they have and we have, I mean, we know exactly all their satellites.
Sure. I mean, that's what happens. It's like Colby. Okay, Colby got away with it maybe because he's so silken, so some people say. Cap Weinberger is about as silken as Edwin G. Robertson. And yet he conned all those people. Everybody he called that I know of, all the news people that he called, said, yes, sir, we're not going to. And you're absolutely right. I mean, they can't possibly underestimate the Russians to the extent where they really believed they were putting stuff on the plane that the Russians didn't know about. My own feeling, trying to avoid conspiratorial theories at all time, and generally succeeding, is that Weinberger is not a dummy either, despite the record. And this may well be part of a pattern on his part to wear down the press, to intimidate the press. He got them this time. Why shouldn't he be able to get them next time? Okay, won't get the Washington Post, but you can't have everything. I don't know. Yeah.
Do away with the parents' stuff and related to access and
Well, I've always gone on this with William O. Douglas, who was one of the few justices on the Supreme Court who was utterly opposed to the fairness doctrine, equal time, or anything else, because he said there is no reason in logic, or certainly in First Amendment law, why broadcasting should be a second-class First Amendment citizen. The American Civil Liberties Union yesterday put out a very nice piece of work. It was an indictment of attempts by the government to get the FCC to punish networks for content. Most recently, the complaint filed by the CIA with the FCC, which was later denied, to punish ABC for printing some information that had some real serious mistakes in it. But anyway, it is not the business of the ACLU, of one government agency, to use another government agency to punish the press. That brings us back to the days of licensing. So I talked to the guy who was the legal director of the ACLU, who's an old friend of mine, and I said, when are you guys going to go the whole way? That's a nice piece of work. When are you going to say that they should abolish everything that puts that kind of constriction on content? Why? I mean, nobody can go to the New York Times or any paper and say, that was a terrible thing you did to the police commissioner. It was unfair. It was disgraceful. We insist that you run in an approximately equal position and with approximately the same number of words an answer from the police commissioner, which you won't touch. That's outrageous. Nobody would stand for that, except 90% of the American public, but never mind. It certainly wouldn't stand up in court. Why should you be able to do it to a television station or a broadcasting station? The notion that this is scarcity is nonsense. It was originally the scarcity doctrine. There are so few channels, broadcasting channels, that the public had to be given mandated access in fairness, because otherwise you'd have this huge monopoly on news, at least in terms of the broadcasting spectrum. There is not one place in the United States of America today where there are not more broadcasting, that is radio and television channels, forget cable even, than there are newspapers. So where's the scarcity doctrine? It doesn't exist. Yet every do-good organization, from the ACLU to NOW to you name it, always puts up a big geschrei every time, and it's true. Most of the attempts to eliminate the fairness doctrine come from the libertarians, capital L, or the right wing. Doesn't mean they're always wrong, and they're right in this case, I think.